Welcome to the Destined for Success podcast. I'm your host, Jennifer Takagi, and this podcast used to be called New Manager Media, Manage Right from the Start. Many of the concepts are the same, but there's a little shift. There's a shift because I know we are all destined for success, and I want to help you find the fastest, smoothest way to reach your highest best as quickly as possible. Join me in today's episode where you're going to come up with new ways to build your skills and influence others to make the impact you desire to make. I look forward to connecting with you soon. Welcome to Destined for Success. I'm your host, Jennifer Takagi, and today I have a very special guest. Christine and I met in Malaga, Spain, at a breakfast women's meeting. And the fun thing about that was everybody had a couple of minutes to introduce themselves. And although I am an international speaker, it was super fun to be an international speaker in Spain because I went to college in Spain for 4 months. I went to a semester in Sevilla. And so it was super fun to be back and go, oh man, I spoke on Zoom in Spain and then at this breakfast meeting. But Christine was the actual keynote speaker that morning at the breakfast. So today we have Christine Milani. Did I say that right? Milani.
Milani. It's Mila rather than R. But you were closer than many Europeans are.
She is an award-winning podcast host, TEDx speaker, accomplished writer, and extraordinary neurocultural communication and public speaking trainer. With over 30 years of international experience, she uniquely blends her rich academic knowledge, theatrical experience, and she's very theatrical, and neuroscience-backed methods to transform how professionals communicate and present themselves. And in this world, in this culture right now, we need that more than ever. And it's just taken us like 10 months to get together with our time zone changes and do a podcast interview. Christine, thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me. It's really exciting to be here. I'm delighted. We finally made it happen.
I know, right? Like all the things that have to align to make something like this happen. So we met in Spain, and you'll hear in a second as Christine talks more that she's from Ireland. And now once we finally got this going, she's actually back in Ireland. So how did you get involved in speaking and the whole neuroscience of it? Because neuroscience is such a buzzword these days because it's important, right? It's how everything works. So tell us a little bit about you and how you got into this.
Well, I'm going to throw the neurodivergent word in there as well, because since we met, I have accepted that I have an ADHD brain and most recently also an autistic brain. So I've got the beautiful new uncertified AUDHD category as well to add on to the neuroscience, but it's a wonderful thing. So your question was, how did I get into speaking? That's the beginning of it.
How did you get into speaking and like training professionals? Because I just saw something in the last week about how in the United States of America, we have to be like very clear. You can't just say in America because America goes a long way south of the US and also north. But being hateful and rude is becoming the norm. And that's unacceptable in my world. But that's what I'm living in. And I think more professionals need more training on how to be an acceptable professional speaker. So it's very interesting to me. And I love that, like, you've made it your passion. So yeah. How do you help professionals get better and not be the hateful people that they can be?
I think it starts with loving themselves a little bit more. That's the first step. I am actually in the process of developing what I call the Irish storytelling wheel. So what I will be doing more of in the future is helping professionals know their stories. And when we start to know and realize our own stories, we begin to see other people's stories a little differently and we have more compassion for them. So the start is self-love, self-compassion, to then be able to have love and compassion for others. And I do that. I do it by being very honest. If I'm very honest, I'm quite direct. I mean, I work on a permission basis. So part of brain-based conversation training or brain-based communication training, which I did some of my training with actually an entity out of the States, the Neuro Leadership Institute in New York. And it's all about permission and looking for possibility. So where people often, and I think leaders often do this, and often people will do it, but I can't generalize to everybody, is they look for the problem before looking for the possibility. So when we coach from a brain-based conversations perspective, from a learner-led or a learner-centered or a heart-centered perspective, we look for the zone of possibility. What is it within you that you have that I can find that we can pull and help you develop in yourself without me telling you what it should be? So does that answer a little bit what you asked?
Yes. And it's very interesting the way you said that, because I'm a certified high performance coach through the High Performance Coaching Institute. Brenda Burchard's, I think, the founder of it. And one of the things is, as a coach, you don't ever tell people what to do. You help guide them to come up with the answer themselves. And so I love that you like reiterated what I already know. If you tell somebody to do something, they may or may not do it. And then I'll speak only for myself. And then I'm frustrated, because when everything falls apart, I'm like, well, I told you what to do. Like, I told you what to do. I love to.
And they're looking at you going, yeah, that might have been the problem.
Yeah.
Because I didn't find it within myself.
I can't take it in, right? You tell me.
Or you told me in a way that works for you.
Yes.
And again, not generalizing as people, we can be very good at this. One finger forward, three fingers back. I'll never forget my dad teaching me that. Those three fingers pointing towards ourselves. Helping other people see their shoulds by giving them ours. And telling them in a way that is our way to understand. And that goes back to your question. How do I help leaders? How do I help anyone that I work with to be a kinder, more compassionate, connected communicator? It is to understand that the way that I perceive the world and the way that I perceive my current reality is different to the way that others perceive theirs. And respecting that difference in perception and understanding that just because my way has worked for me, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to work for anybody else. So my goal is to help people realize that and then be able to ask those questions in a way that allows a person to develop for themselves, to find their own shoulds. Well, actually, to abolish the word should altogether and do something a little differently.
Right, like find their own path, right? Like
this.
I have a friend, and she calls them non-negotiables. Here are my non-negotiables. And it's kind of like it falls into that should category, right? Like, these are my non-negotiables. This is what I'm going to do versus this is what I should do or whatever.
Yeah. I like that, non-negotiables. I've been thinking a lot about boundaries recently, and boundaries and control. And I mean, I've experienced narcissistic abuse, you know, and in fact, even probably narcissistically abused myself in some ways over my lifetime. And so, yeah, I've been thinking about permission and consent and boundaries and control, but I like that non-negotiables instead of boundaries. These are my non-negotiables. So it's not a boundary. It's not even up for negotiation. I love that.
Yeah. Her name's Mary Gooden. She's an absolute delight. And when she left corporate, it was like, these are my non-negotiables and I will not break them. And like, she does meditation every morning and she does yoga every morning. And she has a third thing. I can't remember what the third one is, but it was like, and then she coaches people like, what are your non-negotiables? Like, what do you have to do to create the life of your dreams? So I love that. And it's an easy way to put it, right? Because like, I know what I should do. Am I gonna? Maybe, maybe not. I might do it today, but I might not do it tomorrow.
But I think that can come in as well in neurodivergence too, you know? So for her, the non-negotiables are things that she doesn't change and that works for her. But for someone like me, it's nice to think about having routine. And there are certain things when I look back, say, or look across, whatever way you want to look at reality, I'm exploring the way that reality works at the moment in a very unusual way. But if I look across at another reality that was my past, but that could be in my present, as mad as that might sound, there was a year in my life, 2014, where I would say I was at what has been my optimal in my life so far. And the non-negotiables then were exercise. They were finishing by 10:30 at night. And I used to live in the city centre of Dublin. And it was about a 10 or 15 minute walk from O'Connell Bridge. So I would go to O'Connell Bridge. I smoked weed at the time. And I would go down and I would sit from 10:30 until midnight on O'Connell Bridge, have a little smoke. I'm not talking about destroying my mind or anything like that, but it was my end of day relax, my non-negotiable. Bring my book, read my book, and in between, whatever else happened. And so for me, it wasn't that it was rigidity. There were non-negotiables within the day. One of them was exercise, whether that be in the gym or running. One of them was sitting down, relaxing with myself and my book. And they could happen at any point in the day that worked for me with my schedule around it. And it's the same now. So I hear a lot of people talking about, you know, you need to have habits. You need to get up and you need to be rigid about starting this at this time and finishing this at this time. Dude, come meet my neurodivergent brain. My ADHD is not going to have, it's not going to have that all the time. The autistic, so I call them parents, right? This is how I'm looking at it. The autistic parent is strict. The ADHD parent is fun and a little bit
flexible
out there. Flexible, lovely, beautiful word. So I'm learning to try to balance the two. I'm learning to balance the two and how the two will get on together. But to try to say to that ADHD brain, for anybody who is neurodivergent out there, whether self-certified, I don't call it diagnosis, I don't believe it's a diagnosis, self-certified or not, that if someone is saying to you, this is the way you must be, and you know that, okay, I'm going to bring it back to the I because I don't like saying you. If someone is saying to me, I must be this way, which recently has been happening, loads of things have been happening in there. The feeling is that this is how neurodivergence is. This is how the ADHD brain is. This is how the autistic brain works. This is what you need to remember about how you felt in your life. Hang on a second. Actually, no. I remember my life. And I remember being okay with how I was in my life at that time. Yeah, there were struggles. I remember those struggles. I remember the decisions that I made that I didn't really want to make, that maybe didn't serve me fantastically, but did teach me things. And I'm okay with them. And for anybody who's out there experiencing this, that it's okay to say, yeah, you know what? I'm delighted that works for you. But if I try to do that to my brain, I'm going to be miserable. So for me, it's finding the non-negotiables in flexibility. Let's use your word. That was a great word. In flexibility with the brain. Yeah.
So if, like, I worked in corporate and then I worked in the federal government for many years, and they had non-negotiables they placed on me. I had to be at work at a certain time and I had to work 8 hours a day. And I will say I was very fortunate. Everybody was a little bit flexible on that lunchtime. I liked to go to lunch. That was a little flexibility that we had there. But I had due dates. I had deadlines. And so if somebody is trying to, like, navigate and negotiate a self-certified, to use your term, diagnosis of ADHD and or autism, like, is it just, I hate the word just, but is it something they need to consider a career path or a company or agency that will embrace the differences that they need to work within to not have it be a constant struggle battle? Because I can just, one of my sisters and I teased one time because she was like, Jennifer, I think in the end you make more money than I do. Well, in actuality, I didn't because she got some amazing perks that I would have never possibly gotten. But I looked at her and I said, "You couldn't have worked with the rigid rules. Like you could not have survived." And people tease me because in DISC behavioral profiles, like I'm a 96 I, which is influencing people. And so sitting down and shutting up and doing my work was really hard. And on the C for compliance, like the highest I've ever scored out of 100 is 8, because that's kind of not my thing. And the instructor was like, how did you survive in the federal government? Not only survive, but thrive and do very well with compliance is not your thing. And I went, oh, but I wanted to be recognized for what I did well. And I wanted the awards and I wanted the accolades and I wanted the minuscule bonuses we got because it was better than a sharp stick in the eye. So I was all about it so I could make myself do it. And so I was able to balance that. And so I don't know, like with the self-certified diagnoses, can you manage that or is there another industry or another type of way to make a living that serves better?
Well,
That was a
that's probably
lot.
why.
Sorry.
No, I it's okay. Oh, I got it. I think if I think of me, I think I make good decisions without realizing it. So I discovered through work, and this is part of the story work that I do when I work with clients, if they want to learn their stories and really do the work, I do this thing called a story bucket. So you map the tapestry of your life, and it's based on work that I did for myself. So I essentially went and I looked at my parents, my grandparents, my stepmother, everybody, their careers and what they had done. And then I mapped my life and my job choices based on what I had done and then what they had done. So I could see where everything became the composition of my life so far. And by the time I was 38, I had had 38 jobs in 23 companies on 5 different continents. So, ding, 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 there's the ADHD. But it's also autism because the different things that I did all fed my interests and my desires and my excitement. The reason I moved and changed every time was because I went, oh, I want to do that. I'm interested in it. And I think, now I haven't done a huge amount of work on this yet because this is quite new for me. It was really only the end of last year. It was my mom, no, it's not true. But maybe about 2 years ago, one of my best friends said to me, "You know, you're not able to sit down and stay down the first time you sit down." And that got me onto the ADHD. Oh, maybe. Then last Christmas, my mom had had a conversation with one of my sister's best friends who is certified or diagnosed, whichever word you want to use. But and this is personal to me. Obviously, I know that there are people who need diagnosis because they can't function in the world that is not designed for them. So I'm not trying to negate anybody who uses the term diagnosis, who needs or wants diagnosis, who, and I will probably at some point when I can certify or get diagnosed, as the world would like me to call it. So no, I just want to make that very clear. I respect everybody for where they're at with themselves. This is where I'm at. Mum said to me, "You know, you could have a chat with her because I think some of the stuff she said about ADHD, it's making me a bit aware about maybe where your brain might be at." So I getting that confirmation from my mum allowed me to begin looking at ADHD. Now, I had already done all of the online tests for autism, best test results I've ever got in my entire life. I aced them. And then there's not so much out there for doing it on ADHD because it's different. It's a spectrum. It's a disorder as opposed to or it's seen as a, what do you call it, a psychiatric dysfunction as opposed to a disorder. They're a little bit different. But when I looked at it, I started to see industries, and I was in the ELT industry for a long time, the international education industry, English language teaching. And I mean, I love my English language teaching peers, and I'm not saying anything negative about you all, but I reckon it's probably a very high neurodivergent industry because we all have to have degrees minimum. bachelor's degrees, for Ireland anyway. Many have masters, many have PhDs in a variety of different areas, hugely theatrical, often in history, in very fact-based, riveting in areas that of research. But we get to go into a classroom every day and do something different and use our knowledge to shape a lesson in a way that motivates and inspires people to want to be engaged and to learn. And so we facilitate. So going back to your question, do I think it's important to recognize and choose industries and companies that will be supportive of us in neurodivergence? Yes, I do. I acknowledge that that is very difficult for many at the moment. I know people who don't want to find out for themselves for sure that they're neurodivergent, even though they suspect that they are. And I say neurodivergent as opposed to neurodiverse, because everybody is neurodiverse. We all have different brains. Divergence is different to diversity. And then I know people who are certified or diagnosed, but who don't want to tell their employers because they're afraid of the reaction or the response that they'll get. So I understand that. I don't know, maybe it's part of my neurodivergence and how my brain works. I'm telling whomever wants to listen. Because I don't know, maybe there's a part of me, like in my TEDx talk, right? I said, everyone has a story that if shared can create a ripple effect so great that it changes the direction of the herd. And it can help people find the courage to share theirs. So I'm still willing to stand up and say, this is me. If you don't like me and you're not comfortable with me, that's not my problem. It might not be a problem for you either, but it's whatever you need to deal with. I don't need to deal with that. So we're probably not going to get on. Off you go. And that's okay.
Yeah.
So, am I answering your question?
People we can be friends with. Yeah. Well, yeah. But I think it's an idea of... very few people were ever fired when I worked for the federal government. It was a very difficult, arduous process, even if somebody needed to go. And it was because you needed protection, right? Because in other industries, you didn't necessarily have protections. But after I left, I was talking to somebody and they were in a corporate position. And they said, well, I had to let somebody go today, because they need to go somewhere else where their talents can shine, and it's not going to be here. And I thought, wow, that's a really nice, gentle way to put it. And I'm sure the person ended up technically resigning rather than being fired because of the, you know, what's attached to the firing versus resigning on like putting on a resume. I was fired from that job. But it was like, that's a really nice way, because there's a place for everyone and there's a place for everyone to shine. But if you just keep slogging away and struggling with where you are without finding the benefits. So for me, I'm not certified in anything as far as, you know, neurodivergent or ADHD or anything like that. So I don't think I do. Maybe I do, and that's going to be an interesting find out. But I was able to work within the parameters of the government because I knew where my shortcomings were, but I also could like make it work. I could do the things. But I can see how for somebody else, they may not have that ability, or it might be just entirely too hard, that it's the stress is just too great. But I love that we have so many job opportunities now, and in the entrepreneurship arena, so many possibilities, right? You create your own.
My internet just dropped there for a second. So you said, I love that we have so many job opportunities now, I think.
Yeah, we have so many job opportunities, and being an entrepreneur, like you can find your lane and stick in your lane. So when we're talking about the professionals you work with and the conversations, to get it back to something really tactical for our audience, like, what can I do to communicate more effectively, to have an engagement and an encounter that is more positive for both of us?
So I use, well, I created a model that I call neurocultural communication. And it's based on four aspects of awareness: awareness of self, so the brain, awareness of others' brains, that's the first awareness point, cultural awareness, linguistic awareness. And when we blend all of them together, so self-awareness, cultural awareness, linguistic awareness, what's my fourth one? There's
Others.
the ADHD, self and other, yeah, but I've got four in there. So it's language, culture, the brain. Ah, there's another one. We'll move on. But to relate it to the question you asked me, first, become aware of yourself. What biases may trigger in you when you engage in certain communication with others? Second, how can you mitigate them in advance of a communication engagement? Because what I'm learning more and more and realizing more and more is that the neurodivergent brain and neurodivergent communicators, because of this so-called social ineptitude or inability or lack of social communication cues and awareness, we prepare for our conversations where neurotypical brains do not. I do not see this as a deficit. I see it as a positive. And so, what I'm saying to the so-called neurotypical brain is prepare. Be aware of yourself. Be aware of what the biases are. Consider how to mitigate those biases in advance of the conversation. Learn about the cultural profile of the person you're engaging with. So, if you're coming in to speak to me and I'm Irish, and you're Indian, for example, or you're French Canadian, how you communicate with me will be based on your culture as a French Canadian or your culture as an Indian. But if you consider in advance, oh, wait a minute, maybe the Irish don't communicate in exactly the same way as us, then you can think about how to map your communication onto a conversation or an engagement with them. And that's what I do as a culture coach. So I use something called Culture Active, which is one model of culture. It's actually used in a lot of universities in the US. And I also use the Culture Map, which is Erin Myers. She co-wrote the book with the Netflix CEO about culture in the workplace. And so we sit down and we pull up a map of communication across the cultures that the person is engaging with. And it's fascinating. Like, let's talk about persuasion, for example, and presentations, because presentations and public speaking and using the voice as an instrument is the key thing that I do. When you go into a presentation, say, like, if I'm coming out of America, right? I work with a massive corporation in America. They're multi-billion dollar in the tech area and global. And I work with their European and their Singaporean teams. So what I do is I help them to understand how to communicate with Americans because it's different.
And different parts of the country are different also.
Absolutely. Oh,
Yeah.
absolutely. A Bostonian and a Southerner. I mean, come on.
I'm in Oklahoma, which somebody said, what are we? Because we're really not the South, but we're definitely not the Southwest, but we're not the Great Plains. Like Oklahoma and Texas, kind of, we're like our own little carved out part of the world. And a friend was here and said, I choked myself up just thinking about it. She goes, I could never live in Oklahoma because I don't think I'm nice enough. And
Wow.
I was like, oh my God, that's so funny because everything is please, everything is thank you. You go to the bank and they're like, thank you, have a nice day. I was in Ohio. This woman is a multimillionaire and she went to get a couple hundred dollars out of the bank through the drive-through teller. And that gal, that teller didn't say good morning, didn't say thank you, didn't say have a nice day. And my friend pulled away and her family's from Oklahoma. And I went, oh my gosh, how can you even have your money at a bank with such hateful people? And she was like, oh yeah, in Oklahoma, they would have said please and thank you. And what else can I do for you? And I was like, yeah. Yeah,
So this is a perfect example. Can we use this as an example rather than presentations or anything? So see that and coming away and saying, God, how can you have a business run with people who behave like that? Right? Let's look at Spain. You and I come over to Spain. We go into a restaurant and we are used to really fast service. Yeah. You when I walk in the door, you greet me straight away. You put me in my seat straight away. Within 2.5 minutes, I have a glass of something in front of me. Then I'm holding the menu. Within 5 minutes, I have ordered. Possibly I've got a little bit of bread or some olives or something like that, because you need to make sure that I'm going to stay in the restaurant. Then we go to Spain.
That's not how it works, people. Right.
So it depends which part we're in. And like, so if you're in Malaga City now, it's going to be faster because they've been westernized a bit. But in other parts or in smaller towns, you go in, you might sit there for 10 or 15 minutes and you might have to remind them that you're there. And then you think, or we think, Jesus, how could you run a restaurant like that? That's terrible service. It's disgraceful altogether. It's so slow. They don't care about their customers. There's no interest, nothing. Who's right? Or what's right and what's wrong? Fair enough. But that is a perfect example of cultural biases coming up. So I have an expectation of how you should behave based on what I have learned about behavior throughout my life. If I have never traveled, if I have little experience of being abroad or international experience, then my expectations, of course, are going to be even more skewed towards my culture and my upbringing. And I may be negative towards you then and mistreat you or be rude to you because you don't meet my expectations. Tony DeMello says this in his book, Awareness. Was it? I'm going to annoy myself now because you didn't meet the expectations that I had of you that I didn't express to you. Something along those lines. And that's what it is. And it take it then into the workplace. Workplaces are now global and international. And every single day, we have to communicate with people from multiple countries all over the world. Is that noise coming from behind me or from behind you? Is it okay? It's not coming towards you. Okay. No. Okay. Grand. I hear a rumbling noise. So just in case it was interfering. That's all right.
Well, that whole restaurant analogy I love, because when I got on the plane and left Oklahoma to go to Sevilla, Spain, also known as Seville, I was going to go and as soon as I graduated college, I was going back to Spain, France, wherever. I was never coming back. And I was there a whole semester, so 4 months, and I had traveler's checks. Back in the day, that's how you travel with money. And you would go to the bank and you'd cash them in. So I left early for school. It was a long walk from where we lived to get to the school. And I left early to go to the bank. And I got to the bank right at 9 o'clock when they opened. And I should be able to cash my traveler's checks and get to school by 9:30, and being late was kind of a big deal. Like, you did not show up late to class.
Okay.
I literally stood there looking in the windows. I could see all the employees and the managers, the whole cluster, drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes at the back of the bank. It was like not very wide. It was narrow, but it was really long. And they finished all their cigarettes and all their coffee before they finally opened the door like 10, 12 minutes later. That I'm like, how does this economy not collapse? How do you do this? But then after I had been there for a while and then went to France for the summer, they all had these 5-week holidays and everybody was off for 5 weeks in the summer. And they would go on these grand family vacations for 5 weeks. And there would be a little sign in the door, closed for summer vacation, you know, come back on this day. A couple places I never got to because I didn't get back in the 1 week they were open when I was there. But those are the kind of cultural differences. And obviously they survive. France and Spain are still going. They're still going. They still have people there. It's still working.
And so, long may they not be too westernized, because yeah. They're beautiful cultures to be in.
Yeah.
Because you can go slow. And that's what I needed. I've just spent the last 3 years in Spain, well, on and off, coming between Ireland and Spain. And I needed it. even my pace. When I arrived, I moved so fast and I would pass people all the time on the promenade until eventually I realized I was walking at the same pace as them and life had slowed down. But it's interesting what you talk about there, like in this, the culture map and in Culture Active. So we would call, let's generalize Latin American and Spanish kind of cultures multi-active. So they're in that red, talkative, emotional, gestures, all of that connecting. They're that type of culture. And then we would move down to America, Germany, Ireland, towards more linear aspected cultures. And then if we think about the culture map, we have time and how different cultures deal with time. So there's flexibility of time and less flexible with time. So, I mean, Germans would be the stereotypical international country that is quite rigid with time. You arrive on time and you leave on time.
And their trains are amazingly on time.
There you go. Yeah, yeah. And then you have the other side where they're India. Well, I mean, when are we starting? Meh. We said 10 o'clock, but you might start at 11, you know, and Spain is like that. There's flexibility of time that you can arrive a little late. And as you said, you can open the bank 12 minutes past because you need to finish your cigarettes and coffee. So it's fascinating. So if we go back to that question you asked, how can I be a more aware, conscious communicator? It's aware. It's take a step back, realize. And this is going to sound harsh and might make me unpopular, but America does not rule the world. And that communication around the world is really different to how Americans communicate. You are one of the most direct countries in the world. The context is so low in America that the coin is completely flipped when you go to a country like China or Japan. They are high context. The word no doesn't exist in Japanese. And so if you ask a Japanese person to do something and they can't do it, the answer that they may give you may make you think that they are saying yes, but what they're saying is no. So they might say it could be difficult, but that it could be difficult means no, we can't do it. And you're expected to read the room. It's called Kai, actually. It's a Japanese concept when you can read the room and read the space and understand that what I'm saying in my response is no, but I cannot lose face for the group or for myself holistically by saying no. So I'm not going to say no. I'm going to trust that you're intelligent enough to realize that I'm saying no. And that's it. It really comes with self. Start with the self. Look at yourself. Look at how you communicate. Look at what triggers you. I have a document that I use in line with what's called the scarf. So the scarf comes out of... I mean, Tony Robbins uses this as well in a different way. He's got seven drivers. The scarf has five. They're the human drivers of behavior. So the scarf stands for status, is your S. C for certainty. A for autonomy. R for relatedness. And F for fairness. And most humans are wired towards fairness. They want there to be fairness. And there are some who are pretty low on the fairness mark, but most want fairness. But otherwise, there'll be one of those that are the key driver. You've met white men that are CEOs. They generally are pretty high up there on the status. Now, I'm not saying all men, right? That's, again, I will never say that everything is for everybody. But if you understand that you're highly driven by a need for status, you mentioned this earlier on for you, that you wanted that recognition when you were working in corporate, so that you were able to maneuver yourself and incredibly adapt yourself in a way that allowed it to work for you so that you got what you needed. You met your human drivers. So you knew, I need that recognition. I need to be seen for what I'm doing. So I'm going to adapt myself in a way that allows me to be seen. If we take that to a leader, to someone who's listening today and who wants to be a better communicator and better to be a more connected communicator. What's your need? Do you have a high need for certainty? And if you do, then when you're speaking to somebody who is ambiguous and doesn't give you a feeling of certainty, what's happening inside your body? Are you feeling uncomfortable? Where is that feeling? what's causing that feeling? Oh, they're not giving me the certainty that I need in this conversation to feel secure. So what do you need to do? Instead of getting upset by the fact that they're not giving you what you need, recognize, ah, maybe they're somebody who doesn't need a high degree of certainty, so they don't offer it. So maybe you need to say to them, look, the way that I operate, I need data. I need a bit of statistic here. I need this to be clearer for me. So before you come to this conversation, would you just get a few figures ready? Because I'm going to need that to feel comfortable and confident in it. And when we're aware of these things and we communicate them with the person in advance, we can have better conversations and not have meetings that go on for an hour that tick boxes, but don't actually achieve anything. Because that's fairly common too.
Christine, this has been an eye-opening, enlightening conversation for me. And I love it because we do get frustrated with other people. And, you know, it's not setting parameters. It's not setting expectations or sharing them. And also not doing any of your homework. When I was at school in France, a friend, a fellow student's parents came over and her mom was livid because they didn't have ranch dressing for her salad. And ranch dressing was fairly new in the U.S. at that point in time, but her mom was livid. Like, she didn't know there were going to be differences. She had not considered that there'd be differences. I have loved this conversation. All your contact information will be in the show notes if anybody wants to follow you on social media or reach out. Christine, do you have any final thoughts for our audience?
Oh, I can't hold this in. So I'm asked there for a second to not interrupt you. I forgot about ranch dressing. I haven't had it in years. It's got such an incredible flavor. Thanks for reminding me about that. I don't know when I'll have it again. Is there anything else? Well, find me at Hiberno Stories, because I am shaping how to teach the world how to tell stories like Irish Shanachie's. And there are prescribed methods for storytelling that I see all over the world. They're like 10 different ways to do your story. The hero's journey, the why, the this, the that, the other. My goal with teaching you how to tell stories like the Irish is that you will only ever need one model, and you can adapt all of your stories to this as long as you know them. The final message would be, take a breath. When you get triggered, when you're having a conversation with somebody, look for their zone of possibility and reach into it, because there is one in every single person that you speak to.
That was lovely. Thank you for being here, Christine.
Thank you for having me. And I'm looking forward to having you with me on mine.
Awesome. I'm Jennifer Takagi with Destined for Success, and I look forward to connecting with you soon.
Taking your time to spend with me on this latest podcast of Destined for Success. Please take a moment to leave a review, share it with a friend, and subscribe, and get the newest episodes every Monday morning. I'm Jennifer Takagi, and I look forward to connecting with you soon.